The term organized baseball is constantly re-evolving. The sport was once tied to a handful of teams and once failed to include African American and Latino players who were involved in their own leagues. But integration brought on new opportunities. The expansion of the sport brought on more media, including radio and TV coverage. And with the birth of player unions, demands for revenues from those broadcasts. The expansion also meant baseball academies for Latino players and the rights of a player in the majors to negotiate his own future after so many years in the game. University of Illinois Assistant Professor of Labor and Employment Relations Daniel Gilbert is the author of Expanding the Strike Zone, Baseball in the Age of Free Agency. I'm Jeff Bosser. Today on Focus, we'll talk with Gilbert on the start of player unions. Our conversation begins after this hour's news. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm Jeff Bossert. As Major League Baseball has expanded and won the affection of many fans over the years, the sport has seen extensive growth in the past century. Many of the fan favorites are from Latino countries where a lot of baseball training academies exist. The sport has also been driven largely in part by TV contracts and the rights of players to earn some of that revenue. Daniel Gilbert is assistant professor of the University of Illinois School of Labor and Employment Relations. He's the author of Expanding the Strike Zone, Baseball in the Age of Free Agency. Welcome, Professor Gilbert.
It's great to be here, Jeff.
Talk a bit about your goal with this book. We talked a little bit before the show about being a Red Sox fan and the career path you took, but tell me a bit about what you wanted to tell us in this book.
Yeah, I came to this project for one thing, out of love for baseball. You know, grew up living and dying with the Red Sox in New England, and I hope listeners don't call in and start screaming at us, as many of our listeners today, I'm sure, are very excited about the Cardinals, who are about to meet the Red Sox in the series. But beyond that sort of, you know, love of the game, it was out of a sense for baseball as a really important industry and as a really important cultural form that would be worth trying to understand, both in and of itself and also in terms of baseball's relationship to the kind of broader story of work and employment, which is one of the major themes in the book, but also in the larger story of the place of the United States in the world. How does this thing called Major League Baseball, for example, relate to the rich baseball histories of other countries?
Well, welcome your calls and questions about baseball and labor issues and how free agent contracts have grown over the years. Calls for Professor Gilbert, or you can call us at 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. The term organized baseball has changed a lot over the years. This was really an exclusive term if we go back to like the teens or 1920s. It was very different than what we might look at that or imagine that as today in terms of some of the personnel on the field.
Yeah, and that term organized baseball has a really interesting kind of politicized meaning. The in the early days of professional baseball, there were like multiple competing leagues and leagues rating one another's rosters. And around the turn of the 20th century, the folks running the American League and the National League got together and came to an agreement that they would be Major League Baseball. They would be, and they would control this thing that they called organized baseball, and would then define other leagues that were not affiliated with organized baseball as outlaw. And then for the next four and a half decades, organized baseball, the term organized baseball had a deeply racialized meaning, in the sense that the Negro leagues. Leagues in which players excluded from organized baseball, excluded from the American and National League on the basis of their racial identity. Those leagues were not considered part of organized baseball.
Well, and obviously the biggest name to come out of integration at when we get to the late 40s, 50s is Jackie Robinson. And Branch Rickey, who actively sought out Robinson and a lot more people may be exposed to that story with the movie 42 having right. come out recently. It was
He did describe the management of the Negro Leagues as had the nature of a racket.
That's right, and this is one of the kinds of arguments that big league power brokers like Ricky made in this period, where they are increasingly interested in players like Robinson. Once the modern color line falls, all of a sudden those Negro League clubs are attractive sources of talent for the big leagues. And as folks like Ricky and his contemporaries in general managers' offices around the major leagues look to those teams as sources of talent, they will often describe them as, you know, as Ricky says, in the nature of a racket, or, you know, somehow not up to the standards of organized baseball, and therefore legitimately subject to being rated for their best players.
And let's talk about some of these the Mexican leagues as well. I mean, they tried to compete for some of the talent in the 40s too. You had actually bidding wars, I believe, or these efforts to try to bring players to the big leagues, and others trying to, maybe some that may not make the cut in the U.S. playing there.
The story of the relationship between the Mexican League and the major leagues is really fascinating, and it has a pivotal chapter in 1946, right after World War II, the year, incidentally, that the Red Sox and the Cardinals met in the World Series. That summer, a number of major league players received lucrative contract offers to go play in Mexico, and the Mexican League was in large part run by a guy named Jorge Pasquel, who had an ambition for the Mexican League as a league that could compete with the American and National League on an international scale. And this set off an intense period of institutional battles between major league owners and their Mexican League counterparts, and it eventually led, almost 10 years later, in 1955, to an agreement that allowed the Mexican League, that gave the Mexican League a sort of official affiliation as a top level minor league. But also allowed Mexican league team owners to retain territorial rights to all baseball prospects in Mexico. And this is one of the reasons that the Dominican Republic and other locations in Latin America became more attractive for major league scouts, major league teams to find cheap talent. To sign a Mexican prospect, a major league team would have to and continues to have to buy that player's contract from the Mexican League club. So in 1979, the Los Angeles Dodgers bought Fernando Valenzuela's contract for $120,000 from the Mexican League team that owned that contract. Whereas in 1979 and that same era that Valenzuela came to the Dodgers, major league teams would be able to sign Dominican prospects, for example, for $4,000 or $5,000.
Well, you mentioned Fernando Mania, and we'll jump a bit ahead in history here just because you brought up Valenzuela. And I was telling you before the show, there are certain baseball documentaries that make a really nice companion to your book, including a couple of portions of Ken Burns' original baseball series. And there's another documentary on Valenzuela that was done by ESPN. And it's really interesting that it meant a lot to Mexican players to have Valenzuela be this hero for them. But and it was probably needed, because Dodger Stadium in Chavez Ravine, all this space was cleared out, and eminent domain was used to bring in the ballpark, and this was Walter O'Malley's dream.
That's right, Valenzuela and Fernando Mania as the kind of great cultural phenomenon around the rookie southpaw's spectacular performances in the season of 1981. Was called. It's really part of a longer, complicated relationship between the LA Dodgers and Los Angeles, between the working class communities and Latino communities surrounding the ballpark. And indeed, Dodger Stadium was built on land that was cleared that had been a working-class Latino community at Chavez Ravine. And so there's a way in which the summer of 81, when this amazing young rookie from Mexico ran off a string of 8 straight victories and led the Dodgers to a World Series title over the Yankees, this was a moment for a certain kind of reclaiming of that space in L.A. by Mexican-American and Chicano fans.
We're talking with U of I Assistant Professor of Labor Employment Relations, Dan Gilbert, regarding his book, Expanding the Strike Zone, Baseball in the Age of Free Agency. Your calls are welcome at 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And on Facebook and Twitter, you can reach us at Focus580. What questions do you have about baseball contracts, the free agency era, and how the game has expanded to what it is today? I'd love to hear from you. One of the most prominent names when we say free agent is Curt Flood. And this guy refused to accept a trade from the Cardinals to the Phillies. That was the late 60s, correct?
That's right, end of the 1960s.
And the reserve clause was enacted, and there was a court fight over it. And basically, and I don't remember what player said this, it's like you're a slave. You're to service to this team, and you can't just make up your mind you want to take a more lucrative contract with somebody else.
That's right. Dating back to those early years of so-called organized baseball that we were talking about earlier, the team that held your contract could renew its terms for the following year. So even if the player and the team couldn't come to an agreement and the player didn't sign a contract for the next year, the team had the right under the interpretation of this thing called the reserve clause, which was kind of boilerplate language in players' contracts, to renew its terms. And so when Curt Flood was traded for Dick Allen, the great Phillies slugger, at the end of the 1969 season, he said, "I don't want to go. I've made a career in St. Louis." Flood at that point had been a star with the Cardinals for the whole decade. It helped lead that team to be one of the most really extraordinary teams in the major leagues in that period, beating the Yankees in 64 and beating Carly Stremski in the impossible dream Red Sox in 67, losing a heartbreaker to the Tigers in 68. Flood was a star, and he was a star in St. Louis, and he didn't want to go. But because of the ways in which his team owned the rights to his services under the way baseball contracts work, he had no choice. And so he sued Major League Baseball, and his case eventually made it to the Supreme Court, and the court ruled against Flood. Flood actually lost that historic court challenge to baseball's reserve clause. But what I try to look at in the book, what I try to argue in the book, is that Flood was, along with other players of his generation, a major kind of cultural figure in fighting back against the way the baseball industry worked and the power of Major League Baseball teams to kind of control and define the identities and professional futures of their employees. And so a few years later, after Flood's challenge, players would, in fact, win a modification of the reserve clause and the modern system of free agency.
Well, and Flood seems like he was just mentally defeated. I mean, he was in his early 30s when he retired, probably had a lot of ability left, but he retired after he was dealt to the Senators. I think the Phillies traded him to the Senators. And just barely into the 71 season, he says, that's it. And I was obviously defeated with the whole court entanglement.
Yeah, he ended up spending a number of years in Europe, tending bar among other things, and eventually he came back to the States, and he worked as a broadcaster for a while in the Bay Area in Oakland, the city where he grew up. Flood was one of a number of great African American players to come out of the amateur baseball leagues in Oakland. Frank Robinson, Veda Pinson, among others. But Flood ultimately is I think we could see him as a certain kind of tragic figure in the way that he passed away at a relatively young age in the 1990s, and I think never really enjoyed the kind of full celebration of his role in baseball history that he really deserved. The Ken Burns film that you mentioned, Jeff, does feature some wonderful interviews with Flood talking about his fight for free agency and the ways in which he saw his contract struggle as tied up in the larger black freedom struggle of the late 1960s. And
And two other names that come up with this, too. Two pitchers, Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally. Those were two guys that also solidified the what it means to be a free agent and kind of made this an official thing and was not a problem again.
Yeah, so in the summer of 1975, Andy Messersmith and Dave McNally both played out the entire season without signing new contracts. So taking on this reserve clause that we were talking about earlier. By that point, the Major League Baseball Players Association, the Players Union, had been effectively reorganized into a very powerful body that had, among other things, won a grievance and arbitration system in their collective bargaining agreement. And so they were able to get an impartial third party to rule on the legitimacy of baseball's contract system. And so at the end of that 75 season, an arbitration panel, a three-party arbitration panel, one representative from the union, one from management, and this impartial third party, Peter Seitz, heard McNally and Messersmith's case and ruled that, in fact, these guys were free agents. That that they had lived out, they had played out the terms of their contract, and this set off then an intensive period of bargaining between major league teams and the players' union. And by the middle of the 1976 season, the two parties had negotiated the new system of free agency. Peter Seitz, incidentally, the impartial arbitrator whose decision in favor of the players brought all that about in late 75 was immediately fired by major league team owners under their rights under the collective bargaining agreement to kind of exclude the arbitrators that they didn't want on the panel. And so,
players fought for this. But what does it mean to be a free agent? Because now we think of free agent, and it's kind of an ugly thing. If you think about, I had this document here with all these salaries, escalating salaries, and I don't want to even think about how much Alex Rodriguez now pays, obviously pending his all. Complaints or lawsuits over alleged steroid use, but makes just a ridiculous amount of money per plate appearance. And was this inevitable?
No, it certainly wasn't inevitable. I think one of the really distinctive things about the Major League Baseball Players Union over the years has been the way in which the union has managed to both raise the floor for the 25th player on the roster, the person just hanging on, trying to play long enough to be able to live a prosperous retirement, lifting the floor while also creating the market conditions, if you will, for stars to be able to go out and get competing offers and earn the sort of going rate for their services. So the union early on, and the Major League Baseball Players Association was around for a number of years before it really became a union. It wasn't until 1966 when players, almost by accident, hired this amazing guy, Marvin Miller, who came out of the United Steelworkers, one of the really most important unions in the United States in the 20th century. Miller helped them kind of reorganize into a new kind of association that really was a quite powerful union.
We've got a caller on line 4. Tim in Charleston has a question about free agency. Go ahead.
Good morning, and happy World Series season.
Absolutely.
I wondered if you might be able to give us a little bit of the anecdotes of story. It's kind of sketchy in my memory. The way the free agent market originally developed, it seems that the owners in the union and Marvin Miller were negotiating just how this would happen. And the arbitrator or mediator, I guess, was going back and forth, and he was telling the owners, you know, you're going to lose this. You got to come up with some way to, you know, to control what's going on. And owners tend to be a proud bunch, and you know, wouldn't listen, of course. But it was very strategic on the union's part to put in the restrictions for free agency, so that not everybody was a free agent at once and flood the market. And instead, they kind of, you know, reduced the supply and raised the price.
That's right. It's a really key point that that the caller raises here. Marvin Miller's autobiography is really one of the great baseball books to go to the local library and pull off the shelf. And Miller talks about in that book this moment in the rise of free agency and this really key transformation in the way the baseball business worked, and the fact that yes, the Players Association under his guidance thought very carefully about creating not just a kind of blanket free agency where the market would be flooded and teams would be able to treat every player as a free agent, but rather a limited free agency where only those players with as the system was worked out in 76, only those players with 6 years of big league service time would be able to test the market and be free agents. And that system where every year a sort of limited class of free agents, a small class of free agents are sort of unleashed onto the open market and are able to have teams competing for their for their services has led to the situation where a star like A-Rod is able to receive the extraordinary contract that he has.
I want to thank Tim for the call. We're talking with Dan Gilbert from the School of Labor and Employment Relations about his book, Expanding the Strike Zone, Baseball in the Age of Free Agency. We'd love to hear from you at 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You mentioned Marvin Miller and coming over from another union, but there was, I think, kind of a parallel made around the time we had a strike in 1981. There was the strike that year, another union's air traffic controllers, specifically President Reagan, actually brought in replacement workers at the time. And that's right. He didn't specifically mention baseball, but I think that there was this was kind of an uprising for different unions.
Yeah. So that we were talking earlier about the summer of 81 as the summer of Fernando Mania. The summer of 81 was also quite important and quite pivotal in baseball history as the summer of a great baseball strike. Where the collective bargaining agreement that the players and owners had worked out in the wake of that 1975 arbitration ruling was up for renegotiation, and the team owners were determined to roll back free agency, and the players were determined to keep it. The players won their strike and retained that system of free agency that same summer. The summer of 1981 was one of the most pivotal summers in the history of the American labor movement. President Ronald Reagan fired the striking air traffic controllers, members of PATCO, a union that had incidentally supported President Reagan in the 1980 election. And Reagan permanently replaced those striking air traffic controllers. And in the wake of that action, the use of permanent replacement workers in the public sector, in private industry, has been one of the major management tools to fight back against worker power, workers' right to strike. We've seen a precipitous decline in the number of strikes in this country since the early 1980s. And so the difference between this peculiar union of Major League Baseball stars and the rest of the labor movement is of great interest to me in the book, and I try to argue that what distinguishes the baseball union was the role of star power. That in effect the Major League Players Union was able to make the case that you couldn't have Major League Baseball without these particular players. You couldn't have Major League Baseball without Fernando Valenzuela and Reggie Jackson and Dave Winfield. You couldn't replace these workers in the same way that you could the air traffic controllers.
We're talking with Dan Gilbert from the U of I School of Labor about his book, Expanding the Strike Zone, Baseball in the Age of Free Agency. In the second half of the show, we'll get into a little bit more about the game and maybe some more players and some of the characters of the game. We'll pause here for a short break. I'm Jeff Bossert. This is Focus. And we're back on Focus. I'm Jeff Bossert, and we're talking today about labor relations within baseball and the free agent era. Dan Gilbert is an assistant professor at the U of I School of Labor and Employment Relations. His new book is Expanding the Strike Zone, Baseball in the Age of Free Agency. Well, since we're talking about, I said, characters of the game a minute ago, one of the guys you quoted was Jim Boughton, and he did some write-ups, specifically the book Ball 4. And I told you I have my grandpa's copy at home.
That's right.
I've never read it, but it's something that someday it's on the bucket list. I have to read this
book. Jeff, you got to read Ball 4.
Yeah, I've spoken to Boughton because he's involved with the vintage leagues of the old 1800s rules. But he told it like it is in his book. It's a real sign of disconnect with this brutally honest player, and then some of the media slammed the guy for what he had to say, this Yankees pitcher. Talk about Jim Boughton.
Yeah, Boughton's a really interesting guy. He was a phenom pitcher with the Yankees in the first part of the '60s. Those sort of last great Yankee teams of the sort of Mickey Mantle era. But by 1969, Boughton was trying to hang on as a major leaguer with the expansion Seattle Pilots. A very interesting. History in and of itself out in Seattle in '69. And Boughton published after that season Ball 4, which was a diary style account of his season. And it was a bombshell. It's kind of hard to imagine now a ball player memoir being this kind of a bombshell, but it really was. Boughton was frank and detailed about all sorts of things that happen on a day-to-day basis on a major league team, including accounts of players' infidelities, accounts of players' amphetamine use, the use of so-called greenies, and also accounts of tensions between players and management. Boughton goes into great detail about his own contract struggles and things like that in the book. And after the book's publication, it was actually excerpted in a couple of Look magazine pieces before it actually came out as a book. He was hauled into the commissioner's office. Bowie Kuhn, the commissioner of baseball, gave him a very sort of public dressing down about the ways in which he had, as far as Kuhn was concerned, sort of scarred the game, scarred the public image of baseball. But Boughton's book was one of then a number of player memoirs in that period that began to reframe the kind of larger public conversation about baseball. Kurt Flood himself wrote an extraordinary memoir, The Way It Is, in 1971 during his Supreme Court challenge. Bob Gibson has actually written multiple memoirs. His 1968 memoir has this remarkable passage about the ways in which Gibson saw the relationship between his pitching style, namely pitching inside, knocking batters off the plate, sort of keeping the strike zone his territory. The connection between that and the larger social upheavals unfolding in the streets of St. Louis and other cities. He draws a comparison between the brushback pitch and rioting, which is a really fascinating comparison. So the story of Boughton and of kind of ballplayers starting to really tell their own stories in different kinds of ways in the late 60s and early 70s is, I think, a really pivotal piece of the story of free agency.
We'll love to hear from you. We're talking to Dan Gilbert about his book about free agency, Expanding the Strike Zone, Baseball in the Age of Free Agency, 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, Bell 4 came out, and it's, oh, scandalous. Welcome to all the stuff that happens in the clubhouse. But that seems pretty mild now in what you have in a ballplayer's memoir. I guess one that stands out, and because for other reasons, is the book that Jose Canseco wrote about all the steroid use called Juiced.
That's right. The impact of that book has been extraordinary. I think we're still really feeling the impact of Canseco's sort of version of truth telling a few years ago, and I think you know another way to think about the extension of Boughton's impact and the impact of ballplayer memoirs and ballplayer storytelling is the kind of rise of the athlete Twitter account. You know, these days we're able to, you know, engage with athletes directly on social media. And, you know, we see repeatedly these instances of players speaking their mind, you know, kind of reacting after a tough game or after an incident on the field. And I think it'll continue to be very, very interesting to see how sort of this phenomenon of social media sort of continues to unfold in the coming years. We have, you know, all kinds of new access to players and players have I think growing amounts of power and influence in shaping the way in which their work on the field is interpreted and understood in popular culture.
Since we talked about Boughton, I told you I had to bring this up with you being a Red Sox fan, but going back to the early 70s with Reggie Jackson, there was this group, I think they were called the Mustache Gang, and then the front office eventually decided to embrace this idea. So I'm wondering if you draw a parallel between the Mustache Gang, and I don't know if there's a term that applies to all these Boston players that are about to be in the World Series with these big beards, particularly Mike Napoli, who's just got an enormous beard.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, if anyone is out there looking for a book idea, I think one could write an amazing history of facial hair in baseball. I think this would be a great project. But the Oakland A's of the early 1970s, the A's of Reggie Jackson and Raleigh Fingers and the manager Dick Williams are famous in baseball history for, among other things, in addition to winning three straight World Series titles, being the Mustache Gang. And the story I tell in the book is that Jackson, Reggie Jackson, the great right fielder, showed up in spring training one spring with a beard, you know, with facial hair that the team owner Charlie Finley didn't care for. And so the way the story goes is that Finley then tried to get other players to grow their facial hair so that Jackson wouldn't feel like such an individual. And that you know, therefore wouldn't be so kind of invested in keeping it. And then Charlie Finley, this very interesting kind of idiosyncratic marketing genius, saw a sort of promotional opportunity in front of him. And then he encouraged all his players to grow out their mustaches and their beards. And then by Father's Day of that season was holding a Mustache Day promotion at the Oakland Coliseum. And this became a kind of marketing opportunity. And in some ways, this is an example of an owner responding to of a team owner responding to and commodifying in a certain kind of way and trying to make money from the forms of personal expression of individual stars on his team. So players' hair and uniform styles had been a kind of subject of real struggle, particularly by African American and Latino athletes in the late 60s and early 70s. Players growing out their afros and growing out sideburns and mustaches. Teams had actually tried to prevent them from doing this, and some would continue to issue restrictions over players' hair. Steinbrenner.
Exactly. That's the name that pops to mind, yeah. Because I know that they made fun of it In the Simpsons episode, if you ever seen it, where, mm-hmm. where all the major leaguers join Homer's softball team, and Mr. Burns is telling Don Mattingly to shave his sideburns.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
So we'd love to hear from you if you have any questions about the growth of labor within baseball. We're talking with U of I Professor Dan Gilbert, 800-222-9455. One of the other things that has driven these large contracts is the revenues from TV. And I noticed even a couple of teams, I think it was the Indians, were on HBO at one point, you mentioned in your book. I mean, you had to pay for a channel that you get associate normally with movies and now TV shows to watch a ball game.
Yeah, early on, I think in 73, there were a few games, a few Cleveland games on HBO, and the Yankees had an early attempt at cable broadcasting through HBO. And then, you know, by the early 80s, the rise of the so-called superstations, so Ted Turner's WTBS and, of course, WGN out of Chicago, so you, Jeff, could watch your beloved Cubs anywhere in the country. In fact, in some parts of the country, it was easier to watch the Cubs on TV than the local team. The rise of the superstations really transformed the economics of baseball in that kind of early cable period. The more recent phenomenon has been the disparity in major league franchises' local cable revenue. So teams like the Red Sox and Yankees essentially own their own cable companies. So the New England Sports Network revenue goes directly into the Red Sox coffers, and you know, the sort of New England cable market is large enough that the Red Sox are able to bring in substantially more local broadcasting revenue than, say, the Kansas City Royals are.
There was even a stretch where with the WTBS contract, one season Braves for maybe part of the season had nicknames on their uniforms. And one of the right. players, I think it was Channel or something, on his uniform.
Yeah, that's right. So this is one of my favorite stories from this period in baseball history and from the sort of Ted Turner Braves. So Andy Messersmith, that guy who had brought the arbitration case and had be sort of helped bring about free agency in 1976, Ted Turner signed him for the 1976 season. Ted Turner, who's kind of looking to make a splash, looking to draw attention to the Braves, who are essentially kind of content for what will become WTBS in Atlanta. And among the early kind of marketing stunts that Turner tries to pull is putting nicknames on the back of jerseys. So instead of having the player's last name, you know, on the back of the jersey, they have nicknames. And Andy Messersmith's nickname is Channel, and his number just happens to be 17. And so for a few games in 1976, before the commissioner's office told them to cut it out, Ted Turner's kind of great free agent acquisition was walking out onto the field with essentially a billboard for the team owner's television network on his back.
And it's interesting what the postseason picture had looked like, namely concerning the National League. If the Dodgers were not able to pay these players they got from your Red Sox, I mean, their payroll increased substantially, and they could pay it because of the TV contract that the LA team got.
That's right. That's right.
But this has become a very large issue in terms of what teams can afford. You mentioned the Yankees, and they have their own channel, the YES Network, it'll just be interesting to see what happens as well with the Cubs, because they could end up having – there's less games now on WGN and more games on the Comcast network.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's talk a bit about the game itself too. You have followed the Red Sox for many years, and you know, who are some of your heroes with that team? And maybe how has your interest in free agents period and labor – become identified with Boston?
Yeah, I so some of my first heroes growing up were the were the Red Sox folks on the Red Sox team that went to the World Series in 1986. So, you know, players like Jim Rice and Dwight Evans and Oil Can Boyd and Roger Clemens. More recently, right before I guess right as I was beginning to do the research for this book, I was spending a lot of time in Boston, and just before I went to grad school, I was living in Boston, and I used to go down to Fenway and buy a standing room ticket, you know, probably more often than I should have. And one of the experiences that left a real impact on me was seeing Pedro Martinez pitch in Fenway Park. I've never seen an athlete so kind of at the height of their powers as I have seen Pedro pitch in Fenway Park, and the way in which he just captivated 35,000 people. You know, every time Pedro would get to two strikes, you know, people would be chanting his name, Pedro, Pedro. And so, you know, I think in part I got to some of the interests that I ended up writing about in the book through thinking about this guy, Pedro Martinez, and where he came from. Pedro had come through the Los Angeles Dodgers recruiting and talent development system in the Dominican Republic. The Dodgers, one of the first teams to build a baseball academy in the Dominican Republic, and Pedro Martinez and his brother Ramon were two of the many major league stars who ended up playing for LA, who came through that that system, and wanting to know more about players of Pedro Martinez's generation led me to get to spend some time in the Dominican Republic and researching the academy system and figuring out how we might understand the place of Dominican baseball. The Dominican Republic, a nation with an extraordinary baseball history dating back to the 19th century, how you might understand that history in relationship to the history of baseball in the United States, the history of franchises like the Red Sox and the Dodgers.
Well, we haven't talked really about Asian players either, and today we identify, we think of Ichiro Suzuki, you dedicate a chapter large to him, and we think of today maybe Yu Darvish with Texas. But in the early 60s, there was a Japanese pitcher you mentioned that emerged with the Giants, and I had no idea that someone from Japan had pitched for the Giants that long ago.
Masanori Murakami was a very successful relief pitcher with the Giants, beginning on September 1st, 1964, when he was called up and he made his major league debut at Shea Stadium in New York. Murakami was the subject of a quite intense international incident in the baseball world that offseason. He ended up on the Giants through a kind of sort of working agreement between San Francisco and a franchise in Japan called the Nankai Hawks, who felt like Murakami was still their property, whereas the San Francisco Giants and Major League Baseball felt like he was now the property of the Giants and the major leagues. And so there was, after the 1964 season, a whole kind of back and forth that led to eventually a set of agreements between the major leagues in this country and the Japanese professional leagues over the mutual recognition of player contracts. That agreement would then need to be revisited and revised more recently, when a more recent generation of Japanese stars, Hideo Nomo, among others, would draw interest from major league teams and would become stars in this country.
Got a caller on line one. Mark in Urbana wants to know about ethnic players and how baseball unionization affected treatment of minority players. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to know exactly what you just said, that talked about unionization. We've talked about the changing role of different ethnic players. I was interested in the when the Red Sox reliever actually had a translator with to answer some of his questions. And all of this All of this just raised the issue for me of where unionization has figured in the changing treatment of Latinos, African Americans, Asians.
It's a really important question, and the Players Union has been pushed over the years to represent the interests of all its members. Early on in the late 60s, Marvin Miller sought out the involvement, participation in the union of Latino stars, Roberto Clemente in particular. Miller talks in his book about how important Clemente's participation in the union was. But in that 1981 strike that we were talking about earlier, in the midst of that that really pivotal fight with team owners, a number of Latino players spoke up and said, "We don't have a voice in this thing." In fact, Ivan De Jesus of the Cubs, I think he was with the Cubs at that time,
in the early 80s, yeah,
was quoted in the Chicago Tribune as sort of wondering, you know, what was the role of Latino players, of Spanish speaking players, of players from Latin America in the association. And so, in the wake of that, and as more and more players from Latin America became members of the union was pushed to fight more on behalf of their interests and to do a better job of representing all of its membership. But that has been an imperfect result for the union, and there remain examples of ways in which players from other countries, Latino players, Japanese players, have had to continue to speak up and insist that their union represent them as full citizens of Major League Baseball.
I want to thank Mark for the call. Since we're talking about players from overseas, you make a mention at the last portion of the book about the World Baseball Classic. I wonder if you had any thoughts about that, because we're talking about, you know, players who are suddenly exposed, maybe from Cuba, other players that we actually get to watch, you know, at another part of the country, and it might have a lot of pride involved in some of the countries involved, but you're also worried about what maybe certain players, what international, what team they may end up playing for at a risk of offending another World Baseball Classic team, and then Major League players who are managers who are concerned about their pitcher, you know, blowing out their arm because they threw so many innings before the season even started.
Yeah, the World Baseball Classic, I think, is a really interesting recent development. I mean, for one thing, it's this fascinating kind of joint project by the union and the team owners. It's something that that Commissioner Bud Selig and the leadership of the Players Union have both been kind of really involved with in terms of planning it and seeing it as a global marketing opportunity. But so in thinking about your question, Jeff, I'm thinking about the sort of challenges that Ichiro Suzuki confronted in the Seattle Sporting Press in 2009 when he was getting ready to play in the World Baseball Classic, and writers in Seattle were expressing concern over whether, you know, Ichiro was perhaps a little too committed to playing for the Japanese national team in the World Baseball Classic, and whether that might kind of jeopardize his preparation for the 2009 Major League season. Meanwhile, in Japan, the sort of participation and leadership of the great star Ichiro Suzuki on the national team and on the world stage and in the World Baseball Classic was so important, and I think this is one of the ways in which star players like Ichiro have had to negotiate a kind of dual citizenship in their professional careers. And it's not necessarily new. Players like Juan Marichal and Felipe Alou would in the 60s would have to negotiate a kind of dual citizenship and in playing in the major leagues in the summer and the Dominican Winter League in the winter. So it's not necessarily a new struggle, but one that I think begins to get to the complicated and fascinating transnationalism of the baseball industry.
Well, in addition to your career as a professor at the U of I and author, you're a musician, or have been, and I wanted to play a track here quick. You have a degree from music from Wesleyan University. This is a track off a CD you did called My Housatonic Home, and it's a name for an East Coast river. I,
That's right.
All right, well, let's hear this track.
This one's for the Berkshires, where next year's water falls down. Where the leaves glow like peep show for retirees from the south. Where the revolutionaries laid their bones. This one's for my Housatonic home. And this one's for the ball fields in Pittsfield where the mill teams play. With a hydroelectric.
And we're about out of time here, Dan. But you want to talk about that track real quick? Obviously, you have a baseball reference in there.
Yeah, it's a record that I was really lucky to get to record a couple years ago. And that song is about the Housatonic River, which flows from the Berkshire Mountains down to Long Island Sound and goes through some wonderful old industrial cities. And so that line in the songs about the ball fields in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where General Electric, among other manufacturers, had a long time presence. And so the reference there is to the company teams of GE workers who would have played in played baseball in Pittsfield.
You earned a music degree from Wesleyan University, and then you moved on to American Studies at Yale.
That's right.
Path. So, well, we also have a book signing. We want to mention real quick when we're going to be able to meet you and sign your book.
Yeah. So next Wednesday, October 30th, I'll be reading a bit from the book and happy to sign copies and talk to folks at the Illini Union Bookstore at 4:00 next Wednesday.
All right. I want to thank Dan Gilbert. He's a U of I professor of labor. His book is Expanding the Strike Zone: Baseball in the Age of Free Agency. It's published by University of Massachusetts Press. And remember, today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Any additional thoughts, you can write us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Tomorrow morning on Focus, host Jim Meadows will talk with recovering meth addict Michael Pasley about his ordeal with the drug and Professor Ralph Weissett, who is an expert on rural crime and meth use. That's tomorrow morning on Focus.